I wanted to ask you about the Reagan administration's policy in the Philippines. That there's been Sterling Koenig was here just recently, and he spoke about how Reagan a lot of times maneuvered himself to be in a position where he could go either way on issues. And like, when you look through the, if you read through the press accounts in the Philippines, you do get the impression that he was trying to stay down the middle so that he could maintain stability by backing Marcos and at the same time make contacts with Aquino, the opposition. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if that seems to be a more correct description of what was happening, or was there more of a bureaucratic battle over which way you should go, with the State Department saying one thing, mm-hmm. his advisor saying another, with Reagan very reluctant to leave his buddy Marcos?
Well, I'm not sure either one is exactly right. I think Reagan was certainly reluctant to betray his friend, and I think he let himself be pushed partly because he saw the situation deteriorating, and he really I'm trying to think of how to express it. I don't think he had a design. I think the first hypothesis you said makes it look like he had some grand strategy. He really didn't. I think he didn't. He never did want to go all the way to sort of pull the plug on Marcos until the moment when he did, when I think was the right moment to do it. I think he resisted what his advisors were telling him, and most of his advisors in the government were telling him to, you know, cut loose. Tell Marcos to step down. But Reagan, I think, instinctively resisted it for sort of moral reasons and whatever. But I also think he had a sense not to do it until it made sense. I think he was right to do it when he did it, and he was right not to do it before that moment for the simple practical reason that Marcos wouldn't have stepped down. Mm-hmm. I think only at the time, I forget the exact sequence, but the time that Reagan did finally, I guess it was a phone call or something that Laxalt did, I forget the details. The time Reagan finally did bite the bullet, it was the moment when Marcos really was doomed, and this push from Reagan did it. But people were badgering the president up, you know, for many months preceding that point to turn on Marcos. And Marcos was, I think, too strong up to that point.
I guess it did help to turn on him after the elections as well.
Well, the election, of course.
Push him out.
Oh, of course. Before the election, he was not vulnerable at all. So I think any president likes to keep his options open, and that's, in that sense, it's the first hypothesis is a truism. But I think he was reluctant to do the deed and held off, and even though he was sort of increasingly convinced that this fellow was, couldn't be sustained, but in a way he had better judgment than all his advisors, because I think it would have been, Marcos was still, it wasn't that easy to dislodge up until near the end. That was my recollection. I'm fuzzy on the details.
One of the things we've tried to do in the oral history is to set the record straight on institutional questions, and you may be getting into this at 4 o'clock and in that discussion, but as one read the press, why the great struggle that seemed to be reported daily in the press, comparable to the Kissinger-Rogers mm-hmm. struggle or the Brzezinski-Vance. Was the Weinberger-Schultz struggle. And I don't know whether, how much you'd be prepared to go into that or how you feel about it or whether you'd be willing to say a little to this small group.
Yeah, I was in the middle of it in a sense, because I was with Schultz and writing some of his, helping him with his speeches and in the Lebanon, I was his Lebanon policy. I was very much involved in that. in the State Department. And I think Lebanon, I'll be very candid, I think Lebanon was a case where the president should have decided one way or the other, and yet he had two conflicting policies, one the Shultz policy, one the Weinberger policy, and the president tried to split the difference or make incremental adjustments, which I'll explain in a minute. And so our policy was totally incoherent. To put it this way, Shultz, after the Israelis signed the agreement with Lebanon in May 83, and the Syrians declared war on the agreement, suddenly we were in the position of having to confront Syria in order to defend not only the agreement but the Lebanese government and defend our whole position in the Middle East, because Shultz felt that an Arab government that has the guts to make peace or sign an agreement with Israel needs to be defended. If radicals are able to, undermine any government that makes peace, and this is the end of the peace process, and the Syrian ascendancy in the region would have been a strategic setback for us. So this is why Shultz wanted our military forces to engage more vigorously and in a more timely fashion to affect the battle. Weinberger, reflecting, I think, the sentiments of the uniform military, just did not like being, did not want our military power engaged. And he later gave a speech, well, I'll get to the speeches in a minute. But I also think Weinberger reflected a substantive foreign policy judgment, which is that he didn't want Americans killing Arabs. And the Pentagon has very important relationships with many Arab countries, particularly in the Gulf. And so Weinberger did not like the idea of us, intervening against Syria or seemingly on behalf of Israel or whatever. I think Weinberger's policy is wrong on the merits, because to let Syria defeat a moderate Arab government is the worst thing that can happen to our Arab friends. The moderate Arabs were terrified of Syria, and just as the bombing of Libya was one of the most popular things we ever did, and at least among friendly Arab governments. But therefore, when the rules of engagement for our forces in Lebanon or the naval power offshore permitted American forces to hit back and to engage themselves, but the military would interpret these instructions in the most narrow way and basically not engage in a timely fashion. Every once in a while, they would unload these 16-inch guns and kill a few Syrians, but then they would never follow up. And Shultz's concern was to engage. The president, was caught between these two totally opposite philosophies, and it's what he did was he never quite decided in favor of Shultz, and he never quite decided in favor of Weinberger. And he would authorize slightly more vigorous military activity. But so we never did enough to make a difference, and being there in this half-baked way was not an effective policy. So there was this is one of the major issues. Shultz gave a speech in April 84 to the Trilateral Commission, which I worked on, just expressing conclusions about the use of force and the dilemmas of the use of force and how you either should either engage or not engage. Weinberger gave a reply in November, a National Press Club speech, where he laid out his six criteria for the use of force, which are sort of six unfulfillable criteria. And there's a great battle, and I think the relationship between Shultz and Weinberger had many points of conflict, but that was one of them, and maybe the most significant.
Was there personal feeling between them? Had they had conflict there?
At Bechtel, I don't know. But I think there was a lot of tension, and this Lebanon was one of the most bitter. Now, there was a deadlock on arms control, as you know.
The letter that was leaked just prior to Geneva.
Geneva, yeah.
You went to Geneva.
I was in Geneva. But I'm trying to think, the substantive issues on which they were divided. But I feel particularly concerned about the Lebanon thing because I was there, one of the people, you know, was advising Schultz on Middle East issues. The irony of that is that in the Persian Gulf, when suddenly our Arab clients were the ones asking for help, and we sent our naval forces there, and which I think was the right thing to do, it was risky but correct, and Schultz and Weinberger were in total agreement, you didn't hear a peep from Weinberger about his six criteria. I mean, this is a very risky, unpopular, potentially unpopular engagement with no guarantee of congressional or public support, which violated several of Weinberger's criteria. But it happened. I mean, this proves to me that the issue at bottom was the substance. But our Arab friends wanted us there, and so Weinberger supported it.
How did the debate change after the bombing of the barracks? Was Schultz then, was he then won over to the more reluctant?
No, it was, that actually made it worse because Schultz's view was we had to stay the battles around Beirut were more intense, and there was a great clamor just to get out. And the State Department was arguing about the strategic stakes of staying there, and you can't just walk away. I can go into the Lebanon issues in more detail if you want. What we later came up with, and I went to Beirut once with Don Rumsfeld in January 84. He was for a brief period the Lebanon mediator or negotiator. And Rumsfeld is a very sharp guy, and he figured out right away what this bureaucratic stalemate was. And he came up with a sort of compromise, or a shift of policy, which would have been to take our Marines out, because they were useless, and they were just a liability. And that would pacify a lot of the public sentiment. But in return for that, to expand the rules of engagement for our naval forces offshore, which were the relevant power here. And that was being deliberated over in late January when I think the president finally agreed to it. Just at the moment, then the situation on the ground totally collapsed. So the president implemented what we thought was that policy, but since the situation collapsed on the ground, we never implemented the expanded rules of engagement. But at the time the president pulled the Marines out, the intention really was to simultaneously engage more vigorously with our naval power, but it was overtaken by events very quickly.
There are three explanations people sometimes give of the Weinberger-Schultz conflict. Yeah. One is personal, that they had battles in the past and that they saw things differently. Another is institutional, that one was defense and one was state. And the third was that one really was a kind of realist and pragmatist, and one had both a fairly intense ideological view himself, but also, and that is perhaps reflected in some of the campaigning Weinberger has done since getting out. For instance, we have a rather conservative legislator here, and Weinberger came down and at the end, when this man announced his campaign and launched the campaign for him, and I don't know that Schultz, even if Schultz had agreed with him, would have had a missionary zeal of that kind to get into practical politics. Anyway, past feuds, institutional, or really a different philosophy of foreign policy. With any of those?
Yes, I think all of those are relevant. I think it was also a function of the fact that the president didn't intervene earlier to settle these disputes. I mean, he let the children play in the sandbox too long, and the children started throwing sand at each other, where he should have been engaged himself at an earlier stage to settle some of these battles. As Schultz himself said in the testimony, you may remember, he said, you know, no question was ever finally settled. And that's partly a function of the president's style, where he didn't really like to. He could step up to tough decisions, but he often didn't involve until things were pretty dramatic, particularly where the use of force was involved. He did not like the order of the military to do something that they didn't want to do. And the Pentagon had to be dragged kicking and screaming into bombing Libya, I think. They really didn't want to do it. And Reagan, who has this reputation of being a cowboy, in fact, was very reluctant to, about the use of force. He really didn't like, he very rarely, well, Grenada may have been an exception, but by and large, he didn't, if the military were reluctant, he didn't like to push them. That was part of the Lebanon thing. But, so there's a sort of, he left his vacuum to some degree among the, his cabinet officers. There's just a footnote here, a humorous footnote. I was at a meeting where Schultz and Weinberger, I used to go to some of their regular, their Wednesday breakfast when I was at the NSC. And Schultz joked with Weinberger that on the things, some of the important things that they agreed on, they would lose. They both opposed Graham Rudman. They signed a joint letter to Reagan saying, don't sign Graham Rudman, it's going to take a disproportionate share out of defense and foreign affairs. They were both against subsidized grain sales to the Soviet Union. And there may have been some other things, but issues on which they were they were together, they would get overruled by the president.
You'll probably be the best in... Excuse me.
Yeah, no, and they, I mean, they joked about it, but it, there was the, there was personal tension between them. Arms control is a different sort of thing where I think Reagan... Well, and the NSC was criticized for being too weak and not getting the president to cut through deadlocks. But I actually think, in retrospect, it, it may have been a smart tactic by the administration. To, you know, we did not make concessions easily, and it put pressure on the Soviets. And, you know, I think the in retrospect, the arms control record was pretty good, and... it was a tough, we bargained hard with the Soviets, and there was pressure on us all the time to, you know, make more concessions, and the State Department usually reflected the view to, you know, do a little bit more. And it was very hard squeezing, you know, big moves out of the out of the administration. And so this deadlock was very frustrating for Schultz and for people who wanted us to make big moves. But we ended up making small moves, and which is what the bureaucratic process would produce with great agony. But who's to say that wasn't the best way to negotiate?
You probably, of all the people we're likely to have, will know Schultz the best in terms of having worked close so closely with him. First, could you tell us a little about your notion of Schultz's understanding of foreign policy? He was, after all, an authority in another field, and your one-time boss, Henry Kissinger, tells stories about that. You've heard the story that when he had to give an economic speech, why Kissinger boned up and mastered it, but he never felt it in his bones, and he said at one time that it was the same with Schultz on diplomacy, that Schultz learned all that he had to learn, but he never felt it in his bones the way, by implication, Kissinger.
Well, it could be. I think a test of a secretary, a good Secretary of State, is whether he's in charge of the State Department or not, or whether he's a prisoner of the bureaus. The Foreign Service, I mean, I'm a great admirer of the Foreign Service, but they... And they respond well to strong political leadership at the top. If they don't get strong leadership, they, each of the bureaus has its own instincts and sort of particular biases, or a particular, there's a particular culture. And the Near East Bureau has this, the European Bureau. And so my view is, you know, the Secretary of State needs to be, have his own view of things, and that is more politically informed, or perhaps even more a strategic judgment, and should not be the prisoner of what the bureaus tell him. And I think it, the Middle East is a case where I think Schultz was, did it well, and I think Schultz had his own instinct for how to deal with it, and he didn't sign on the dotted line when the Near East Bureau, you know, said do this, do that. And here's a case where the Secretary of State was making policy and definitely in charge. And I mean, I'm a little biased because I was involved, as I said, I was on the seventh floor and had a little influence over this, but I thought at least the secretary was making up his own mind. I think the European Bureau, which is very strong, I think in this case, Schultz was a little more tended to follow the advice of the career people, and I was at the NSC at the time I was kind of frustrated by the direction they were moving in. But in fairness to Schultz, I think the president was basically sympathetic to a much more forthcoming policy toward the Soviets in the latter part of the administration. Maybe it's unfair, but I wasn't sure whether Schultz was getting a contrary view. Since I wasn't there, I wasn't in the department then, I'm not sure he was getting a second opinion. But I think, I have to say, the president was himself in favor of this new direction, so I can't really fault Schultz. It's hard to say. It varied from issue to issue. I adore Schultz. I worked for him closely. I liked him a lot. I still do. But I think on some issues I didn't like the trend of things in the building, and I wish I had stayed there in this sense to sort of fight the battle and give him a different opinion.
Who else influenced him? Did Nitze influence him? Did who else had impact in what areas on him, do you think?
In Middle East policy, there was a man named Charlie Hill, who was his executive assistant, who was an old Middle East hand and was in a sort of totally obscure position, but it's a key position. He's sort of maybe it'd be like the parliamentary private secretary or something in the British system. But he was just a personal aide to Schultz over, just there all the time, and he, I think, had some influence on Middle East policy. Roz Ridgway, I think, was somebody he respected a lot. Now, I used to have great disagreements with Roz. I respect her a lot, too, and I think she had some influence with him. Nitze, I don't know. Paul was way out on the leading edge, saying things that I think the administration never could go... on SDI, which I think Nitze never really liked, Schultz knew that the president liked it, and therefore Schultz never would go as far as Nitze wanted. But he certainly had enormous respect for Nitze. Trying to think of other issues.
Any of the Soviet experts? Maddox or anybody else?
Matlock. Well, Matlock was in Moscow. I don't know. I think the Near East Bureau, the European Bureau, which was Roz Ridgway, Tom Simons was a deputy. I think they had a lot of influence, which is appropriate.
Any outsiders have influence on Schultz, Kissinger, or others?
Well, not Kissinger. It's hard to say. I think Schultz has a strong ego. And he seems, very nice, mild-mannered fellow. But he's got great strength. And he'd been in the job for a while, he didn't like criticism from the outside. And he got a bit annoyed with Kissinger, among other people.
Which is ironic, considering Kissinger's statement that the one person he would trust enough to be president would be Schultz.
Yeah, well, I think Schultz started out in the job feeling his way around and not, being quite modest. After a while, I think he felt, he came to his own, he knew his own mind. After a while, he had his own ideas of how he wanted to do things, which he should. And as I said, he's a person of some strong convictions, and he...
When the turn came, when there was this shift from building situations of strength and confronting the Russians, whether it was 85, 86, whenever it was Schultz a prime force in bringing about the change? Did he influence the president to drop all evil empire references?
I think it was 1984, and at that point I was with Schultz and sort of helping him do it, because early 84, was it January 84? I remember a speech, or maybe it was a presidential speech, that Schultz had some influence over, it was where which the president declared his openness for a new policy toward the Soviets. And then in the, I think, you know, maybe the election campaign had something to do with it, or maybe this was the point at which the president felt we should cash in on chips or something. 83 was the year of confrontation. The deployment of the INF missiles was crucial, and we had to do that. And the Soviets were kind of out of business for a while. They didn't have a leadership that we could deal with, and they had walked out of the arms control talks at the end of 83. But 84, I think, it was a blunder on their part to walk out of the talks. And but then, you know, so the onus was on them for failure to negotiate, and it made it very easy. The president said, gave a speech saying, you know, we're ready to do business in 84. And I think this was I think Weinberger was very nervous that this might lead to something. That's when it really started. Then at the end, after the election, the Soviets were willing to talk to us, and the talks, arms control talks, began again in March 85. And there was actually a Gromyko meeting in early 85. But I knew that the Soviets weren't going to do anything until after the election. They weren't going to do Reagan any favors or give Reagan any victory. But I think Reagan was postured all throughout 84 to move in a new direction.
Is the rumor about Nancy having an influence something that is at all credible?
My impression is yes, and that Schultz worked with her. Mm-hmm. I think I don't have any first-hand knowledge for that.
Did Weinberger fight a rearguard action to the very end against arms control?
Well, you mentioned the letter that leaked before the Geneva summit. I think Weinberger would fight within the range of whatever was still open. And in arms control, you always have new decisions to make. You know, there's a negotiation, you make a proposal, the Russians make a counterproposal, and you're faced with a decision whether to do something new. And Weinberger would just fight to make sure we didn't make a big concession the next time around. They also used the compliance issue. A lot of these are legitimate tactics. The Congress has mandated, I think some conservatives in Congress got this in the law, that the U.S. government has to report periodically on whether the Soviets are cheating on arms control agreements. And for a long time, there was a lot of evidence they were. So Weinberger would be pushing for a very hard-hitting report, and the State Department would always try to water it down. So the battle would take these different forms.
How do you explain that Weinberger has never changed, apparently, on arms control, at least from his public statements, whereas his so-called mentor, at least in the beginning, Richard Perle, has changed, or has he?
Well, Richard hasn't. Richard is a good friend, and I've been talking to him lately. Richard doesn't believe in funding the two land-based missiles right now, but he'd rather spend the money on SDI and the B-2. So on the funding, it's just his, and the headlines in the Washington Post, of course, highlighted the things he was against, and he's always been against he's always been against the midget man. No, I don't think Richard has changed that much. I think he has a sense that the strategic threat isn't the same. I mean, it's obvious, and so he would make a different allocation within the strategic forces budget. A lot of our conservatives don't like the midget man. I think it's a waste of money.
Are these the big two on the defense side, if Schultz and some of the rest of you are on the state side? Or is the public right in thinking that in opposition to arms control, the real leadership came from Weinberger and Perle?
Or was yes.
INF, particularly INF treaty.
Well, Richard and I disagree. I mean, he was the father of the zero option, which some of us think was not a great idea, because it started this process of denuclearizing Europe, which is we're still living with the consequences of that. So Richard is the father of that option, and I don't think he ever intended it. I don't think he ever expected that the Russians would agree. But he defends himself with the argument that if we hadn't had that position, we never would have survived the 83 deployment crisis. He thinks it's only because we were in this, you know, position of being willing to give them up that we survived the battle in Europe, and that's not necessarily wrong. He doesn't trust the Soviets. I think, I mean, now he sees a big change in the situation, but I'm not sure he's in favor of arms control even now.
Richard, do you have any questions on these weapons, strategic things?
Well, actually, no. I was wanting to ask you, when you were talking earlier about people in the various areas of the State Department having influence on Shultz, who, aside perhaps from Elliot Abrams, was the big influence in Latin America?
I think it was Elliot, and I think I'm a great fan of Elliot Abrams. I think Elliot saved Shultz from further bureaucratic struggles. Before Elliot was there, it was Tom Enders and Tony Motley, and it was also a time when Gene Kirkpatrick and Bill Casey were in the administration, and the right wing was constantly sniping at Shultz because he visited Managua for a meeting with Ortega, and he was exploring diplomatic options on the advice of the Latin American Bureau, and he was constantly getting sniped at by the conservatives. And he would try to explore a diplomatic route, and he'd get this flak. Elliot put Shultz, I think, in the perfect political position, which is to explore diplomatic options. I mean, Elliot was sophisticated enough to know you have to engage in diplomacy, but it was enough of a hard-nosed policy that it protected Shultz from the right-wing sniping. So Shultz really didn't have, from the point of view of domestic politics, Shultz never had to worry about Latin America again as a cause of conservatives beating him up. I mean, he had problems with the liberals, but I'm in favor of a fairly strong policy, and I think Elliot is sophisticated. As I said, he's sophisticated enough to know you needed diplomacy, just as Chet Crocker did in the African area. So I thought Elliot, in a way, helped Shultz a lot politically.
You mentioned Gene Kirkpatrick as sniping at Shultz. Did he have problems with her throughout the administration?
I think on some of these issues of the Reagan Doctrine, the conservatives are very suspicious of the diplomacy. The liberals are suspicious of the, say, military support for insurgents or friends. And yet I think a two-track policy is inevitable. In fact, someday I may write something about all this. Chet Crocker is an example of somebody who succeeded with a diplomacy while we were helping Savimbi, but it was always controversial. And Gene just, I think, reflected the conservative view that she was afraid that the diplomacy would undercut the Contras, which is what conservatives are always worried about. And they always doubt the sufficiency of your dedication to the Contras. But I think, again, I think Elliot came along and put Shultz in a position where he was no longer vulnerable to these charges.
Did Shultz worry about these attacks?
Well, they frustrated him. And in fact, the issue of linkage. I was with Kissinger at a time when we fashioned great theories of linkage, linking the regional issues to the bigger issues. Shultz repudiated the whole theory of linkage in a speech in California in October 84. And the reason was he was he was tired of the conservatives using these regional issues or various episodes, such as including the KAL shootdown, the killing of Major Nicholson in Germany. And Weinberger and various people would always jump on these issues and say, no, we should slow down arms control because the Soviets have done something bad. And so Shultz didn't like all these issues, regional issues, being used by his opponents to slow down arms control. And so he fashioned a... I mean, I didn't really agree with him on it. I used to argue with Shultz about it. The speech shows, I mean, he won the argument, but no, I think it's fairly restrained in its tone. He was frustrated by these various issues that would be, he thought, were being exploited.
I'm curious what you think about the effects of the budget cutbacks at the State Department in, I think, 87. Do you think that shows less of a dependence on the career foreign service? Or?
The State Department always has a hard time fighting for its budget. I don't think it's an issue of the foreign service, except insofar as the Congress, in its motivation, has always given short shrift to the whole enterprise of diplomacy. And I think all of us think it's a tragedy. I mean, Shultz and Weinberger, as I said, were allies on a lot of these things. Think of the defense budget and the foreign affairs budget really are both, they both rise with the same tide and they both get cut when the climate is wrong. And the foreign affairs budget includes State Department operations, it includes foreign assistance, it includes our contributions to international organizations. And all these things are essential. And foreign policy, foreign affairs in this country don't have a constituency in the abstract. And it's a big tragedy. And the State Department was hit with the responsibility of protecting diplomats. I mean, the diplomatic security. After the bombings in Beirut, a lot of money dedicated to building new embassies and fortifying our facilities. But then that, at the same time, you know, there are all these other needs that we like to take care of, like foreign assistance.
May I ask another a question about another area where Weinberger and Shultz apparently were in agreement? You can probably guess what it is, Iran-Contra.
That's right.
Is it credible that neither one knew anything about the diversion?
The diversion, I think this was done in, very bizarre, through bizarre channels. But they both knew about the other part.
Yeah. And they argued against it. Is that pretty definite that they are?
Oh, yeah, and
Evans and Novak said they didn't argue hard enough.
Well, I can't blame them for that. But the president has the right to overrule them. This is, the famous Abraham Lincoln story.
Yeah.
And the president has every right to decide, even if everybody's against it. But when a president does that, he takes all the risk on his own shoulders. And the NSC staff is not really suited for implementing policy for a lot of reasons. So I knew about it. The Iran policy, I knew about it. I was working for Poindexter. I told them I thought it was crazy. So they didn't ask my opinion again. And I was smart enough to put it in writing on one occasion. So.
Did they have Middle East experts who were advising McFarlane?
Well, there's an interesting issue here, and I have to, again, I could tell you I was against it, but there's a legitimate point of view, and a lot of people who got us into this business were not foolish people. They were people, there was a school of thought that we should do more to reach out to Iran. Graham Fuller, who was a CIA analyst who's now with RAND, who's a friend of mine, I used to disagree with him all the time, he wrote a memo in mid-1985 saying the Soviets are making inroads with Iran, which was true at the time, or seemed to be true. He said we should rethink a lot of our policy. And this, I think this has all come out. There were some people on the NSC staff, including, I think, Don Fortier, Howie Teicher. There are various people who thought there was a strategic argument for rethinking our Iran policy. Now, I remember when Graham Fuller did a memo, as they did a memo to Casey, and Casey sent it to Schultz, and Schultz sent it around to me and Dick Murphy and asked our opinion, and I wrote back saying I disagreed with it. I didn't think we should be making obsequious overtures to Iran. Now, then there was a draft NSDD exercise, which the NSC staff came up with a draft directive, which they circulated for comment, and it argued for a new policy. And again, I participated with other people in the State Department in trying to shoot it down. Now, this is a totally legitimate activity by the NSC staff, to try to challenge the prevailing wisdom. I think Graham Fuller deserves a lot of credit for writing a memo which went against the prevailing wisdom. And I just disagreed with him, but this is a legitimate point of view. Now, what none of us knew was that the NSC staff and the president then were going to end up implementing it on their own, and excluding the rest of the government after the rest of the government had said it was wrong. But Poindexter is not a career military fellow with not a lot of exposure to strategic issues. I think he was persuaded that there was a strategic case here. And Don Fortier, who was Poindexter's deputy, I think they had a lot of influence over the president. And I think McFarlane, after he left office, had concluded, by the time he left office, had concluded that it was a failure. And McFarlane had shut the thing down after by the end of 85. But when he was there, again, all these people thought they had a great strategic idea, and I think that's why the president felt for a long, long time that there was a strategic purpose, because his NSC advisors had told him this. After McFarlane left, I think the idea was in the hands of people with less sensitivity than Bud, and so the idea revived again in a slightly, obviously bizarre form. And I think selling arms, made it worse. But even if it hadn't been selling arms, I was against the idea of chasing after the Iranians.
This wasn't something that I've heard you talk about in another context. This wasn't the regional specialist pushing a pet idea then. That wasn't a major factor.
Well, no, the regional specialists in the State Department, who are Arabists, basically. It happens to me that on that issue, I'm an Arabist. I was against the Iranian business, and I thought my Israeli friends were crazy to be doing this. So NEA and my office were unanimous in disagreeing with it. But it was this Graham Fuller at the CIA who thought we ought to, rethink policy, and some people at the NSC, and Michael Ledeen, who was a consultant. And these people are not stupid people, but I disagreed with the idea, and I think it was crazy to try to implement it in the bizarre way they did.
One leading official in the Eisenhower, we must go on, give you a little break between things, but one person who was very high in the Eisenhower administration made the following comment when we had him here, that yes, Ike delegated, but he never forgot to whom he delegated, and he always badgered them in one way or another and asked questions about it. Did Reagan ever do that, or did he delegate and then forget about it and not, as the Tower Commission said, not really keep hands on in this kind
well, of... Iran-Contra is a jumble of a lot of different things. The Iran policy, the policy of selling arms, was something Reagan knew about and wanted and consistently insisted upon, even though his advisors, the cabinet secretaries, frequently objected. So this is not a case of Reagan being out of it. This is the opposite. It's a case for an issue in which he was very engaged, I think partly because he was persuaded of that there was a strategic argument, and secondly, he was torn by the hostage issue. He felt that very personally. So this is a case of a strong presidential direction. Now for the rest, the contrapolicy, it was a case of Poindexter and North taking on their own shoulders something that they shouldn't have done. And I believe Poindexter, when he says he took the responsibility. In other words, he was trying to implement the old policy of plausible deniability to protect the president in an era when the Congress has sort of prohibited this style of doing business. And so Poindexter and North in particular took on themselves all of the political risk as well as the legal risk. Though I think the law is very fuzzy, and I wouldn't prejudge the outcome, even though these issues are actually never going to go to trial. The diversion of funds, you know, is it legal or illegal? The Boland Amendment, none of these things are really going to be likely to be resolved. But Poindexter, I think, you know, in the manner of say a European head of an intelligence service or something, would decide to protect the boss from something that was too delicate. And we just can't function that way anymore. I don't know. Reagan delegated, I think the more basic problem is that Reagan let the bureaucracy do its thing too long before intervening himself on all sorts of questions, whether arms control or Lebanon or whatever. And deadlocks develop sometimes, or even a fuzzy compromise develops, which isn't always the right thing. Reagan used to prefer to have the bureaucracy come together and reach some compromise among themselves first. That's what he preferred, and he could ratify it. If there were divisions, he was capable of making the decision, but he preferred that, say, on arms control, they worked something, Shultz and Weinberger worked something out, you know, some new position for the U.S. to take. When there were deadlocks, they festered too long, and he didn't like to make a, you know, categorical decision one way or the other. And in Lebanon, I think, as I said, I think it was a bad way to make policy. Panama, too, toward the end, he never resolved it one way or the other. The State Department wanted a more vigorous policy against Noriega, and defense didn't want to do, the military didn't want to do anything. And so we just sat there, and we had a totally ineffectual policy. Until Bush cut through that deadlock and got the military to, you know, do great things.
Again, it was a compromise, I think. I mean, the rhetoric against Noriega kept going, and it really put him in a bad position, put Bush in a bad position.
Well, this, I mean, during the Reagan administration.
During the Reagan
administration. Yeah, well, we got launched into this confrontation with Noriega without any real preparation. We got launched into this by the Justice Department,
right,
or by a U.S. attorney. And I think the foreign policy community knew about this indictment that was cooking, but this was right in the wake of Iran-Contra, and nobody had the guts to say no to the Justice Department, you know, and be accused of coddling drug kingpin, because the Justice Department was quite capable of leaking the very next day that, you know, somebody was obstructing justice. So we let this thing happen, and Noriega was a minor issue until the indictment. And suddenly, our prestige was engaged, and we had no strategy to follow through. And Shultz had a strategy, which was to make more use of our military facilities or our military personnel, and, you know, throw our weight around, which might or might not have worked. Although I think, at least I can think of one period of time when it might have helped. And the military didn't want to do that. So, and Reagan, again, this is a case of Reagan did not want to order the military
to take it,
to do something I didn't want to do.